I'm Steve Mosier. I'm president of the Executive Council, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker this morning, Nigel Cameron. Nigel is president emeritus of the Center for Policy on Emerging Technologies in Washington, D.C., which he founded in 2007, and he's the technology features editor at unheardof.com. I'm just reading this because he told me it was mostly true. So, I know him from the 90s when he served as distinguished professor of theology and culture at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He was the first provost of Trinity International University. More recently, he was a research professor and associate dean at the Chicago Kent College of Law in the Illinois Institute of Technology. Nigel has spoken at ASA meetings in the past, including a meeting at Edinburgh, and he was one of the early speakers at our local chapter in the Wheaton-Naperville area. So it's wonderful to have you back. He's got a recent book called Will Robots Take Your Job? So we'll all want to get that book, I think. A plea for consensus. And The Robots Are Coming, Us, Them, and God. So these are provocative titles, and he's going to speak on human flourishing. So it's exciting. His title is a question, A Human Century. Please come up, Dr. Cameron.
Thank you very much. But you also need the lavalier so they can record you.
Thank you very much.
Right. We're good there.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great treat to be here. Those of us who live, work on the East Coast always have a special respect for those who fly from California and come to the first session of the day. Although you can usually tell who they are looking around the room. I'd thank Mike Paul for not least his role in my invitation, but also picking me up at the airport yesterday. It was great to chat to a former fellow countryman, also to my old friend Leslie Wickman. It's a great treat to be here now that she is an executive director. While I was chatting with Mike, I was reminded of a story from when I first immigrated to this wonderful, then it was a very wonderful country, now it's we're not going to mention his name. Back in 1991, which does seem quite a long time ago, although this is a fairly grey-haired assembly, so, you know, we go back. And I was out doing some shopping. We, you know, just moved. Wife, dog, five small children, of course, that's all moved on. I was in the supermarket and talking to the young woman at the checkout, who was being very affable. Of course, people are in this country. Back in Britain, they all talk to each other, you know, while you try to buy things. And she said, you know, she's where are you from? I said, I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm British. She said, how long have you been here? I said, just about a week. She said, your English is very good. I mean, you can do a lot with that story, but feel free to help yourself. If you go to Washington, D.C., where I worked for about 10 years, on the wall of the House Science Committee, which for some reason is now used to be the House Science Technology Committee, it's now the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, even though the U.S. pretty much abandoned space, of course, 40 years ago. On the wall of the House Science, Space, Technology Committee room, you see these words, quoted from Tennyson, Alfred Lord Tennyson, the great Victorian poet, from his remarkable poem, Locksley Hall. Anyone heard of Locksley Hall? Any sort of humanities? Thank you very much, both of you. like people here. A poem from 1835, and it's a futuristic poem. And you can read it now, of course, on your devices. More interesting, in parts than what I'm going to say. The two lines are quoted on the wall of the House Committee Room. I dipped into the future. Far as human eye can see, saw the vision of the world and all the wonder that would be. Locksley Hall. Later on in the poem are words not quoted on the wall of the House Science, Space and Technology Committee room. Knowledge comes, but wisdom lingers. Words written, interestingly, back at the height of the Industrial Revolution, the original Industrial Revolution. A word, it seems to me, of profound significance for the 21st century. And this is, if you like, a thread. I have various beads, you wonder how they all fit together, but I just put them all on the piece of string, and you have to cope with that. I apologize for not using a presentation, that is to say, PowerPoint, which increasingly is now called a presentation. I was wondering to myself, it's a bit like, you know, the tree falling in the forest. I mean, if the professor makes a speech without a PowerPoint, did he say anything? And I do occasionally use PowerPoint. It isn't a matter of religious principle with me. When I have a lot of data to get across or something like, or I'm going to have a really sleepy audience. But I do generally prefer to use a spoken word, and of course, I have the accent. Written in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. And Tennyson is an interesting character for all sorts of reasons. He lived pretty much right through the 19th century. We even have earlier recordings of him reading one of his poems. And he was looking forward to a world of extraordinary change. Much of the poem is all about the sky and space and commerce in space, up there in the blue, and armies fighting up there. It is an extraordinary piece of work. The big issue of the 21st century is whether or not, as knowledge comes, wisdom will continue to linger, or whether wisdom can begin to catch up. Will this century be one fundamentally marked as the century of the triumph of technology, or fundamentally as the most human century so far? In which technology has enabled, has empowered us to fulfill our human destiny? That seems to me to be the question. Context is one, of course, in which science, technology, engineering increasingly are one, in which, you know, convergent technologies, we have all of this talk of 10, 20 years ago. Fascinating, that terrific presentation we had last night from Doug Laufenberger, which framed the whole thing in human terms. Of course, it's coming from bioengineering. I mean, our traditional categories, science, technology, engineering, are sort of clusters of disciplines. The significance of these things is beginning to evaporate. We find ourselves being pressed increasingly into the fundamental question, which is the human question. I think there's a sense in which, you know, the old time science, of course, the word is not that much of an old word, but back in the 18th century, you know, you could be a demographer, and you could be a clergyman, and you could be a botanist, and because there was so little information, you could operate in different disciplines. And in a sense, the wheel has turned full circle, because now, of course, data is almost indefinite, and it's finding ways to frame all this information, to turn it into knowledge, and ultimately to find a context in wisdom. Which is central. You know, the trillion-fold decrease in the cost of computing and data processing, which we have become extraordinarily used to. And even though the Moore's Law curve is slowing a little, it's still moving up. And as we look ahead, we can anticipate that pretty much everything is now going to be reducible to data, therefore remarkably easy to manipulate for good and for ill, and also remarkably open to interference by those whom we sweetly call bad actors. This is the context of this century. Of course, commerce and government, now far more significant in the development of science and technology than ever before. As we were amusingly reminded, for those of us who think Schadenfreude can be perfectly okay with the 19% drop in Facebook's market capitalization a couple of days ago. Let's not talk about hubris and nemesis, the largest drop in value of any company in the history of the world. thanks to what the Washington Post had a wonderful piece 2 or 3 months ago on what it called Mark Zuckerberg's Sorry Not Sorry tour over the last 10 years. And it had all these clips from him going to every conceivable assembly in the world saying sorry. And then Facebook faces the next challenge. Technology, extraordinarily powerful, increasingly powerful. How this will work for the human question. Now, you hang around long enough, as some of you know, and you get really interesting invitations to do things you know not very much about, but they come in anyway. And 3 years ago, I was invited to go to Lisbon in Portugal to a conference convened by the Champalimau Foundation, which mainly funds brain research in Europe. But they've been going for 10 years, and they wanted to have a celebratory conference with a difference. So I had a letter from the chair of their trustees, who was then former Brazilian President Cardoso, one of the Brazilian presidents not in jail, most engaging and delightful man, which was beguilingly written, I have to say. We all get conference invitations every few days. This was beguilingly written, and it was also snail mail. And it said, a child born today may well be alive in 100 years' time. I'm always amazed by demographic projections, because no one knows what's going to happen a week on Tuesday, but they say, oh yes, yes, the actuaries say yes. 50% boys born today alive in 100 years, something like that. And I had actually had 3 new grandsons born in 3 families the previous year, so I found this particularly appealing, and I talked about them in my presentation. And after they'd be invited back, or at least 1.5 of them, to the conference in 100 years' time. And I spoke, the topic I came up with was the human question in 2115. And we had a wonderful dinner. So those of you who know Lisbon will know the Hieronymus Monastery, which is this ancient monastery on the banks of the Tagus. And we'd had a celebratory dinner there. It was some of these things you remember, in the old library there, it was a table with 160 of us, 80 each side, and we had a big candelabrum in front of each one of us, and it was a lot of fun. And I said, in 100 years' time, will we do that kind of thing? Will that be at the heart of our sense of what it is to celebrate, what it is to look back on achievement, to look forward, what it is to come together as leaders, as thinkers? Will it be something like that, or will it not? And this seems to me a criterion in the way in which we think about what is being delivered by these technologies. So what I'd like to do in this brief time, I'm take 3 soundings in things that are going on and then draw 1 or 2 conclusions. And there are 3 very different kinds of things that are going on. First of all, what's happening in China with social credit. I'm sure some of you have been following this disturbing story, though most stories from China are disturbing. So what they're basically doing is taking something like our credit bureaus and letting them loose on absolutely every point of data you can find. Officially, this thing will click in 2020, we're told. Began 2014. And it's credit agencies on steroids. And it's largely a voluntary system. It will be compulsory at the top level. So, for example, if you aren't pleasing the Chinese authorities in one area of your life, they will make your life difficult in other areas. Quote here, they will allow the trustworthy to roam everywhere under heaven while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step. So in February 2017, this is an actual data point here, one of the Chinese courts announced that up to that point, in 4 years, 6.15 million Chinese had been denied airplane flights. They were not allowed to fly. 1.65 million were not allowed to go on trains. And, it's illegal in China not to visit your parents, which is a bit older, I think maybe that's quite a good idea. But it's illegal not to visit your parents. This is now a law. But, factors like that. How often you visit your parents? And, whether you search online for things they don't approve of. What your neighbours make of you. All this peer stuff. All of this goes into a centralised system. And will determine, the mortgage rate you pay, whether you can get rent a flat, anything that requires anybody else's approval in your life will be determined by everything they've gathered about you. And this is a brilliant model of profound dehumanization and control. It was, of course, C.S. Lewis. You can't go far without coming back to C.S. Lewis, who said in his little book, The Abolition of Man, interesting, 1943, in the middle of the Second World War, very, very interesting timing for that book, talking about the meaning of technology, which is really what it's about, where he says, you know, man's power over nature is in fact the power of some men over other men with nature as an instrument. And I think, well, that really could be written on the wall of the House Science, Space and Technology Committee. That is exactly how it is working out. And my reference to Mark Zuckerberg's loss of $119 billion in value 2 or 3 days ago is certainly a reminder of a case in point. So, and of course, you know, the typical dystopia, Gattaca, one of my favourite films, the way in which ultimately knowledge, information, data is used to dehumanise rather than to enable human flourishing. Second example. Again, very recent. Some of you will know about the Nuffield Bioethics Committee. Back in the UK, the UK doesn't have an official National Bioethics Committee as the US has in the last 3 or 4 administrations, I gather, but it's not one at the moment. Okay, I'll tell you a story. I was talking to someone in the know in Washington about this. And he said, oh, apparently there had been some sort of push to the White House to set up another version of a National Bioethics Committee. And the two names that have been suggested for it were Wesley Smith, who's a friend of mine, and maybe some of yours, writes the National Review, and Dr. Oz. Sorry. That apparently has not happened yet. The Nuffield Committee, set up about 20 years ago by a foundation, is a de facto National Bioethics Committee. And they have just produced a report which actually finally breaks this ground. And says that we should not only permit therapeutic germline interventions. And of course, this stuff with CRISPR is now much, much more palpable than it was as a theoretical discussion 20 years ago when the UN and so on were discussing these things. We should now actually approve non-therapeutic interventions, enhancement interventions. Just 2 criteria apply: that this must be good for the individual and good for society. Now, of course, Lewis was speaking about this back in The Abolition of Man, and up until pretty much every responsible, every authority scholar who said, well, actually, maybe therapeutic interventions are okay, 25 years ago they were saying even they weren't, they say, oh, but, only therapeutic, which of course itself is a messy thing, because how do you ultimately define norms and talking about psychology and so on, but this is out there. And, I mean, my immediate response to it was, I mean, the arrogance of today. You know, we all think that here we are, July 2018, we finally pretty much got it sorted out. But you go back to the 1950s, and racism was absolutely the norm. You go back to the 1970s, and certainly homophobia was the norm. And the gay issue is a complex issue to discuss, but very few people remember that President Obama ran for office the first time as an opponent of gay marriage. I mean, changes take place very, very fast. And of course, you go back 100 years, here in the United States, eugenics was the norm. Eugenics was an Anglo-American project brought into disrepute finally by Nazi Germany. It was an Anglo-American project. Every Secretary of State was inviting everyone to the eugenics conferences on behalf of the US. We know all this. And the arrogance thinking that today is the day we finally got it sorted, so we can decide what are going to be interventions for the benefit of the individual and for the benefit of the social order. Of course, at the moment, I think the latter is mainly a comment on sex selection type issues. Because at the moment, we think sex selection is pretty much a bad idea because look what's been happening in India and in China and so on. But the notion that you can impose on the next generation or 2 or 3 or indefinitely whatever we now think is a good idea seems to me Lewis was absolutely right that this is turning your progeny ultimately into what he called patients of your power. I'll tell you a quick story. So back when cloning was a big deal, 20 years ago, cloning was a lot of fun, partly because it got me on TV a lot, and I'm sure some of you too. You know, it was a big, suddenly an ethical issue became a big public question, and we can all jump in. And one of the fun things that came out of that for me was I was hired by a speakers bureau to go around the country on campuses having a series of debates with a very nice guy called Greg Pence, who's a sort of libertarian bioethicist whom I became quite friendly with. And we had a lot of fun turning up at campuses and being paid to slog it out for a couple of hours. And I always had the better arguments. He usually won the debates, but that was fine. And so this is a Massachusetts story, which is why I thought I would share it. And so the most unusual debate we had was in a prep school. Here in Massachusetts, a very liberal prep school, I won't mention the name, some of you will know it, a 19th century religious institution, which is now quite not where it was theologically, progressive prep school. And once a month, they would have this big lunchtime do to get everyone together. This is kind of what prayers ended up with. In the chapel, lovely wooden chapel building. About 1,000 teenagers there. A lot of parents there. It was a special weekend. And Greg and I were going to have this debate. They broadened it. It was about cloning and germline engineering. It was a broader discussion. And so we were there in the green room beforehand. And they said, well, we've two things before you go on. We hope this is all right. We've got a choir singing a piece. And then we have a student activity report. So I think we were expecting the chess club, you know, or the softball team. I mean, so the choir sang a spiritual, which was great. And then we get the gay-lesbian alliance, or gay-lesbian-straight alliance, or whatever the terminology was then. And these two teenage girls sing how they come out. One was lesbian, one was omnisexual. I don't think I'll forget her saying that. And they had a faculty member, and, you know, God bless them. I mean, I'm really pretty open on sort of stuff, and, I doesn't worry me at all. Then we were all asked to stand in solidarity with these people. And my colleague Greg and I said, he said to me, Nigel, we're guests. I think we probably haven't got to join in with this. So we sat there looking distinguished. And 1,000 people stood up. And then they got onto the debate. And Greg was out there arguing, libertarian guy arguing, yes, genetic interventions, germline, rah, rah, rah. So I stood up and this was just too good to be true. And I said, look, if we were all designing our babies, how many gay babies would ever be born? And 1,000 people stood up and cheered. And I won that debate. But I think you take the point. The third case, I'm taking soundings. I could relate all these if I had a lot of time, but they're beads on a string. Soundings. Recent work on the Industrial Revolution is really very interesting and very, very disturbing. You know, the general approach to technology in political circles and economic circles is don't worry about it, it all turns out right in the end, everyone gets better jobs, a bit of disruption on the way, but, you know, sit down, shut up, and you're a Luddite. Ignoring things like the Luddites actually were skilled craftsmen who've been using technology all their lives and were being disrupted by another technology. They weren't the sort of Luddites of today who want to close everything down like the Unabomber. Recent work is really very interesting. For example, Andy Holday, who is not a sort of Luddite activist, he is chief economist of the Bank of England. In a speech to the labour union movement in Britain a couple of years ago, said that between 1700 and 1850, the unskilled labour force in the UK expanded and the skilled declined. In fact, the skilled portion of the labour force dropped from 40% to 20% over 150 years. Which is the sort of the wider scope of the Industrial Revolution. The narrower scope is about 60 of those years. Halved. Wasn't they lost their skills? It was their skills were no longer wanted, and they were either competing with children to work in the factories. Half the jobs, Industrial Revolution factories in England, were designed for children and were done by children. They were competing with children and machines designed to be worked by children, or they, of course, were competing in the fields with unskilled labour. There was a radical de-skilling in the labour force. And very recently, an article by Carl Benedict Fry and two colleagues. Fry was the guy who, with colleagues, wrote this report back in 2013, going through every job in the Department of Labour job classification, all 903 or whatever it is, and analysing them mathematically for their capacity to be turned into robotic jobs. And Fry has now turned his attention to something a bit closer to home. What's been going on in the, if you like, the Trump hinterland, in the flyover country of America in these last 40 years. And he says, in fact, that the 60 core years of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, which would be 1780-1840, are almost exactly the same in profile to the last 40 years in the US. That is to say, skilled labour, lower middle class, stagnation and drop in income caused by technology. And he has a very memorable sentence in his article, which I'm certain will never forget. He says that the Industrial Revolution in Britain did not simply end with the railways. It ended in 1848 with the publication of the Communist Manifesto. Technologies have consequences, and it was mentioned I wrote a book a couple of years ago for Polity and Wiley about robots and jobs as a risk issue. I don't know what's going to happen. Let's draw a risk matrix. Let's get worried because really bad things might happen. And let's begin to prepare. And having read this piece by Carl Fry, I think I'm a bit more motivated by being reminded about the publication of the Communist Manifesto as one of the results of what took place. Of course, by about 1860, everyone got better jobs, economy is moving up. There'd still been a big redistribution of value between labour and capital, but the new base began to rise, and everybody was happy. But this was everybody's grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It wasn't the everybody's of the first generation. Fry also makes the point, which is a point in his segue to Trump. Of course, he says, in the first part, early 19th century, the workers did not have the vote. The human question. Why does the human question matter so much to us as Christians? Now, I think one of our difficulties in this discussion is we've tended to regard human as not necessarily a good thing. That is to say, Jesus is divine as well as human. Humanists have sort of captured that word as an anti-religious term, even though that's not really what it meant historically at all. You know, Erasmus, the great sort of intellectual of the Reformation, was the definer of Renaissance humanism coming into the Reformation period. But the centrality of the human in the technology-driven world is something which seems to me Christians need to capture and to articulate and to understand is at the heart of what it means to hold our creed in this generation. A couple of quotes I love from the 19th century. One from Charles Wesley, for those of a Wesleyan disposition, about the humanity of Christ. Because this is the point. Human matters because we're made in the image of God, round one, and round two, because we're made in the image of God, the Son of God can take human form and does to himself. And that human form has not merely been left behind. It isn't merely an epiphenomenon of salvation history that Jesus was human. I think one of the most undervalued doctrines of the Christian faith is that of the continuing humanity of Jesus Christ. So, yes, Wesley, for those of you who are Methodist Arminian, of our flesh and of our bone, Jesus is our brother now. Well, for the more reformed among you, like me, Charles Hodge, who was the most significant American conservative theologian of the 19th century, down the road to Princeton. The one who sits on the throne of the universe is both perfect man and perfect God. And the core Christian belief is that of the incarnation of the Son of God. And his incarnatedness, which of course is the theme of the Gospels, which are a good block of the New Testament. Evangelicals have not been very good at taking the Gospels seriously. We much prefer Romans, it's a lot more fun, we get into the whole scheme of things. But for some reason, Jesus did spend 3 years or so of his life going around doing good, causing a lot of trouble, and teaching. And manifesting this incarnation, which wasn't some sort of theoretical blip in a scheme, it was an actual encounter with human life, human form, human flesh, without sin, but in every other respect, the human flesh and the human form that we have, and which we now find ourselves, it's our legacy, it's that which we as believers, as we move into this increasingly technologically defined context, are those, perhaps the last and the most significant of those, who see this as central to what it is, what matters for the human community. One of the interesting things about Christianity, compared with all other religions and ideologies, is the way in which we have been able to balance the corporate and the individual. That is to say, we believe heavily in the radical unity of the human race, and equally so in, if you like, the unity of those called out of the mass of the human family into the elect, into those, the family of those within the fellowship of faith. And yet, equally, we uphold the dignity and the accountability of the individual. And in a certain sense, we have, you know, we have 100% of one and 100% of the other. Versus those who simply in terms of the mass, and of course the 20th century, which in many ways I see as a sort of blip. I think the 19th is much more relevant to the 21st than the 20th was. The 20th century was fundamentally about the defeat of the great mass ideologies of communism and fascism at absolutely enormous cost, phenomenal cost. Ideologies which had their origins, of course, back in the 19th century. In the 21st century, there's a balance to be struck. Increasingly, we're pulled toward, if you like, the other extreme, whether it's a libertarian view politically, and you, Ayn Rand and so on, you push this toward an extreme, or, of course, the other kind of individualism, I mean, the sort of the pothead, you know, the New Ager. There are various ways in which you can frame that sort of individualistic decision, in which you ultimately deny that no man is an island, that you're a part of the main. These seem to me to be the extraordinary alternatives that within the Church of Jesus Christ we're able to bring together. So by saying the 21st century needs to be about the human project, we are saying neither it needs to be about the mass human corporate project, nor about merely the individual project, but about our vision of human nature, in which, if you like, our Lord himself is one of us, and, as Scripture says, also the first of many brothers and sisters. So back to Tennyson. Knowledge comes, but wisdom lingers. And I'll give you context here, because with Bible texts we tend not to and to ignore the context, we just use the text for our purposes. That's a joke, but it's not an entirely unserious joke. Tennyson, knowledge comes, but wisdom lingers, and I linger on the shore, and the individual withers, and the world is more and more. Because that's precisely the point he's making. And that seems to me at the core of the agenda of the 21st century. The thriving of the individual, free and responsible, under God, as our technological powers flourish, our accountability under God for our brothers and sisters, and our wariness of technologies, use of technologies, in which, a la Lewis, conquest of nature, use of nature as an instrument over others. And in a context, and I'll finish with this, in which, of course, the largest, five largest companies in the world, even despite what happened to Zuckerberg a couple of days ago, are these new technology companies, in which we have utterly failed to respond to them with the kind of antitrust approach we took to rising monopolies in the past, in which they have become far more powerful than they need to be as they snap up competitors and new rivals, and in which we, as those who use these companies and who applaud many of their dimensions and capacities and services, as this wonderful DARPA invention of the internet, taxpayer-funded, you know, handed to Silicon Valley, now enwraps the world with the kind of potential for the power of some over others, which Lewis spoke about, which this is the environment, social and technical in which we find ourselves. How in the 21st century we end up nailing down human freedom, human flourishing, as that which is primarily enabled by these remarkable human achievements under God. Thank you very much. I think that's an extraordinarily central question, not least because so much of this activity is now taking place in private corporations, where there's far less accountability than there is in a government context, as of course there was in Manhattan. Manhattan, at least you could say, well, this is the government, you know, we voted for it. There's a different kind of accountability in that situation. I think one rather interesting thing, I mean, I'm not really a sort of bomb-throwing radical, but we've seen these examples in the last 2 or 3 weeks of several of the big technology companies have had pushback. Microsoft, just a few days ago, by employees asking about Microsoft's contract with ICE. And then earlier, I think, in 3 of the big tech companies, about collaboration with the NSA. And 2 or 3 of these companies pulling out of contracts because of pushback. Because, of course, if you're in Silicon Valley, you need engineers. And engineers come at a high price. And you disaffect your engineers, and they're going to walk. Interesting, this little strands of a surprising kind of accountability, because by and large, people who are tech companies have not been known to be political people. But I think that's one emerging strand here. I think at the end of the day, I mean, the Nuremberg defense is no defense. You can't say you were just obeying orders, which cannot be, you know, justification of anarchy, in which everyone makes all their own choices all the time. But I think, if you like, a kind of moderated anarchy. That is to say, ultimately, we are responsible for what we do and what is done with our stuff. And we have in conscience to, I think, come to terms with that sort of moderated accountability and the fact that we ultimately can always walk. One thing I find very discouraging is so many people in public life and in professional life who get involved in bad stuff. The notion that they can just walk, you know, they actually haven't got to do it. And yeah, walking is a problem. I mean, you end up with no money, you know, or you end up, you know, with career messed up. But I mean, so what? And those of us who believe conscience is primary, that really shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you. I've been asked to select a question, so what
were yours? I was intrigued by your comment about saying that the end of the Industrial Revolution in England was the Communist Manifesto. And then, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that there's a comparable end, if you will, to the Industrial Revolution in the United States with the rise of what's appealing with Donald Trump's message. The one thing, though, that I'm trying to understand is that, if you'll pardon the bad pun, the elephant in the room in a present situation is that the dislocating effect of technology doesn't seem to be part of that message, but instead saying that we can continue to follow the Industrial Revolution model as long as then we set up appropriate trade agreements or otherwise bring those jobs back. And so I'd like to explore that or get your take on this, to then say, is there really a signaling of an end comparable to the Communist Manifesto in the United States with the rise of what is appealing with Donald Trump, if that whole area, if I'm not mistaken, of technology and its displacement hasn't been addressed?
Well, thank you. It's a very, very interesting way of framing the question. and of course, I mean, the most recent example is because of this latest trade spat causing problems in agriculture. We have another $12 billion being handed out, you know, to American farmers, most of whom, of course, are corporations, to sort of buy them off in a sort of rather random way, not driven by policy, just driven by the need to tamp down backlash. I don't think anyone seriously believes, anyone who is not committed to the Trump agenda, and even most of his people aren't committed to his agenda in the trade area. I mean, Navarro is pretty much on his own. Even Cutler doesn't agree with most of this stuff. And he's a crazy guy himself. But I don't think there's any serious opinion that he can, that basically you can bring back all these jobs and you can make the Midwest, you know, traditionally, people are going to have these, you know, 30 buck an hour jobs and so on and so forth, like they did 40 years ago. I don't think anyone seriously argues that can happen. I think talking about it happening plainly has had political benefit. I think even U.S. Steel is in difficulties, even though it's the one company which seems to be seriously benefiting from what's been going on. I mean, just to flash back, I mean, David Ricardo, who was probably the second most distinguished economist in history after Adam Smith, certainly in the British tradition. Ricardo lived through the Industrial Revolution, and he is the man credited, although this is now debated whether it was really his idea, but he has been credited with being the guy behind globalization. Because he came up with a theory of comparative advantage, which as economists in the room will know better than I do, I have a mere MBA that I did in my spare time a few years ago for fun, is actually a much more complex idea than it seems. But the basic idea is that you do what you're best at and we all benefit. And Ricardo agreed with the Luddites. And he's on record, he agreed with their analysis. He said this is going to be disastrous for skilled workers in England. But he said, because, of course, he believed in his own theory about globalization, he said, this will be disastrous to them, and he said, if, however, we stop these technologies, they will go abroad, and then, he has this marvellous phrase, he said, then these jobs will be annihilated altogether, because they'll all be done by the Portuguese and the French and the Germans and so on. So he was keenly aware of that, and he saw, therefore, a certain inevitability about the way in which technology is going to cause disruption. I'm not sure standing, you know, you can commute-like, just sort of stand there as Trump seems to want to and halt those developments. I think you can mitigate them, but that involves, I think, a much more sophisticated approach to policy.
I wanted to ask you to articulate your definition of the human... I'm sorry, what is the phrase? The human question?
The human question.
I think I know what you mean, but I'd like to hear you articulate your definition, if you would.
Well, there are, what was that famous example, the guy who said, well, I can't define it, but I know what it is when I see it. I think, at a theological level, we can talk about the flourishing of humans made in the image of God in the terms in which God intended them to flourish. It's a sort of circular notion, but that you know, humans doing what God really made them to do. And I think within notions of humanism, a non-atheistic humanism, which we look at the humanities, you know, which is a term we use for this whole clutch of disciplines, historical, cultural, linguistic disciplines, in notions of culture, notions of relationships, healthy relationships, freedom of decision making, there's a whole clutch of things. And of course human rights, which I have not mentioned, which in a sense was the one interesting thing to come out of the 20th century, and which was a fundamentally Christian project. I mean, the Enlightenment did good and bad things, but it essentially secularized some very good things and made them sort of publishable to the wider world, at the heart of which was the notion of human rights, which I think is fundamentally it's basically the what does it mean? You're made in the image of God. It means to have rights, responsibilities, which have come out of this special dignity. Now, of course, you can pull it in different directions and do crazy things with it, but that fundamental idea of human rights, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, foundation of the United Nations system, I think is enormously important. In fact, I've said to students in the past, and I'm now saying this to smart people who know much more than I do about a lot of these things, but get away with things to students, can't you? I said, you know, the two most consequent documents of the 20th century were Lewis's Abolition of Man, 1943, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 5 years later. So it seems to me there's a clutch of ideas there. I think we can't define this thing. We can't come up with 10 points of human flourishing. But I think part of it is just we know it when we see it. It's not taking kids away from their parents, because you want to punish the parents, you want to punish the kids. It's not building gulags in North Korea or in Siberia. But neither is it mothers looking at their mobiles when they should be talking to their kids. I mean, there are all sorts of levels to dehumanization. I think you can have different models. I just as an example of the mobile thing, I've just written a Christian book about mobiles and us, for people in Britain, so they call mobiles rather than cells. And I give a story. I mean, some of you have heard of Tiffany Schlein, whom I interviewed recently, and whom I've known on Facebook for many years. She's a filmmaker. She founded the Webby Awards, which is the sort of the Oscars of the internet. It's a big deal. And she's writing a book now about what she calls a technological Shabbat. And her family, they're non-religious Jews, but basically Friday night, Saturday night, everything is off. Absolutely everything. She says it's transformed their lives. I mean, there are things you can do, right? That's a human thing. I love that. You haven't got it yet, but it's a human thing, and I love it. So I think there are. There's a smell here, which can get stronger, which can be unclear sometimes, which tells you this is a human thing and that this is good. And I think that this is a challenge we have, and those of us who are in the tech business one way or another, and at least know about this stuff, and who are trying to live as Christians, and most of us have families of various kinds. I've got 13 grandchildren now, goodness, my final daughter is just getting married and she wants to have some more. I mean, all those Christmas presents, we're in this business now. This generation is the generation. We've got to find a way to sort these things out and enable us to live. Well, of course, you can go back to Lord of the Rings, and Frodo and the Bill, all that kind of stuff. I mean, there are various ways of imaging, the good human life, which needs to be compatible with the high-tech life.
Mark Strand, North Dakota State University. I want to explore your suggestion that technology is a kind of excuse for humans to control as humans. Friedman said technology has made the world flat. I think some argue the internet is the great democratization of the world. I tend to sympathize with your position, but I'd like to hear your comment regarding some who would say no, religion is the excuse to control people, and those technologies have made the world flat and democratic.
Yes. Next question.
I need help answering it.
Couple of comments without writing a dissertation here. I think, guess what? We're humans. We're fallen. Was it Chesterton who said original sin is the one Christian doctrine capable of empirical verification? Boy, was he right. And so we will use anything we can to try to control everybody else. Anything and everything is good, bad, indifferent, We'll use a Bible. Goodness gracious me. A number of Christians who use Bibles to control people in the sort of cultic end of Christianity. Goodness. So we'll use anything we can. Anything that comes to hand, because controlling other people is a big part of the whole sinful deal. Of course, religion. And I get more anti-religion every day, I have to confess. I mean, I'm a Presbyterian Christian, mainstream, mainline Presbyterian. I much prefer fighting liberals to fighting conservatives, so I'm stuck with the mainstream. That's a joke about, let's go, I'll go, yeah. Yes, gross abusive religion, of course, in the latest Catholic stuff, Peter, just horrible, horrible, horrible. Of course, We can't just go back to being like Jesus and not associating with believers and so on, but our churches need to be far more transparent, accountable, and I think my suspicion is we've just begun the beginnings of the evangelical pedo-sex sort of scandal stuff. I think it's going to come out increasingly. I think really bad stuff. But technology is almost by definition a control mechanism. I mean, from the ads and then much later the wheel, fire. I mean, these are all leveraging efforts, and you just do more because you have the technology, and therefore whatever if you're trying to do good, trying to do ill, but of course because of original sin, the pointer is keeping pulled this way, and you've got to be pushing. And so I think it's an inherent problem. And therefore, one doesn't at one level blame people who are pulled in that direction. But I think, just to take a relatively trivial example, but it is a non-trivial example in and of itself, you just look at the way in which the spread of the cell phone, and of course the smartphone, with all of this marvellous stuff it can do, very much to do with the phone, is distracting mothers, many mothers, from their children. Fathers too, but fathers tend not to be around their kids so much. And within the church, as much as anywhere else. Even walking down the street, they would be talking to the child in the stroller 15 years ago, now they're chatting with their friends. Because the pull. And therefore, I think technological power makes being human, being Christian, being moral, much, much more difficult. And are we up to it? Well, apparently God thinks we're up to it. No? I mean, one thing, I just read this book about social media and mobiles. I think he said, okay, Babel is behind us. You know, basically now, we're on the verge of being able to talk to anybody in the world in real time. We're getting very, very close there now with translation technologies. This is a fundamental theological question. Babel is behind us. I find it very amusing that, because we have all these translation companies and apps called Babel, Babelfish, but whatever, there are dozens of them. And probably not one person in 1,000 who works for these companies or uses these realizes that this does not come from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, Adam's got this from the Bible. But you know, you have to, if you enjoy irony, you can enjoy a fallen world.
I'm Matt Andreese. I'm a high school teacher in science. You've made a point about the talk you heard about the question of whether we would choose our children to be gay. I guess it's more of a comment, not to prove the response, but I guess it raises a question we have to grapple that God has chosen to make some of us gay. So I'll leave that at that. But my question to you was, when you mentioned the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, I wonder, being a little grayer than myself, I was born in 72. My understanding is in 1973, through Gordon College Conference on Nucleic Acids, the idea was born among molecular biologists to contain recombinant DNA in labs. I wonder if there's been any serious discussion of using space to contain recombinant nucleic acids.
Well, and the answer is I don't know. Although there is a lot of fun stuff popping in space. I mean, it is extraordinary when you begin to look around. There's very little federal interest. It seems that some of you, I mean, you may not know this, but one of the most interesting statistics in American history is that, I think it was around 1967, almost 5% of the entire federal budget went to NASA. It's now around 1/10 of that proportion, despite rhetoric. Some of you will have seen, some of you may be involved with some of this fascinating work about mining asteroids, which I think is really quite extraordinary. There's a lot of stuff out there in the literature about it. And they've now found an asteroid which is so packed with precious metals. If we brought them all back, we could almost make everybody on Earth a billionaire. Now, of course, you'd have to find some way to maintain, you know, to maintain the pricing of scarcity in this new environment for that to work. But I think some really fascinating things are beginning to happen. And I think we're going to have a lot more, if you like, commerce in a sort of general sense with space, a lot more coming and going. Now there's private enterprise. I mean, one of these asteroid exploration things is about sending up a traditional sort of rocket, and it sort of bursts open, and you've got about 100 little things floating out there. I mean, miniaturization in space is something really very new, which is going to make things an awful lot cheaper because, of course, the weight issue. So, I mean, I think tracking the space thing is increasingly interesting for those that know not very much about it. One of the joys of my life is meeting Neil Armstrong at a reception in Washington some years ago. I had a great chat with him. I had discovered during the event when he was being presented that he and I shared a birthday. Now, mine was a few years later, but we shared a birthday, August the 5th. Interestingly, Tennyson's birthday was August the 6th. It would have been kind of fun if we'd all been the same day. So I had a great chat with you know, the man, you know, and one of the most modest men you will ever meet. It's interesting how technology is not reading people quite as modest as that in the age of Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg. I divert, but thank you.
Well, we're out of time, and I thank you very much.